War Room, Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to War Room Impeachment. It's the 1st of January, the year of our Lord 2020. The curtain comes up on a new decade. We're here on Capitol Hill in the War Room, episode 95. This is our special, our New Year's Day special on the Roaring 20s. I want to thank everybody for getting up this morning or just coming in, as you would have it.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We're in the John Fredericks Radio Network, AmericasVoice.news, Salem Radio Broadcasting throughout the nation, and of course, Newsmax TV. Chris Ruddy and the team down there in Florida doing an amazing job. Joined by Raheem Kassam. Okay, yesterday we had an amazing show. Peter Navarro, Raheem Kassam, and yours truly, Stephen K. Bannon, walked through this decade of disruption. Started with the financial collapse in 08. It lit the fuse on two populist nationalist revolts, one in the United Kingdom, the other in the United States, and led throughout the world, eventually to places like Italy and Brazil. We'll get to all that. But I want to go back. Now, this is the second part of the special. This is the Roaring 20s. What we look ahead. And we always got to start in the United Kingdom, because the United Kingdom is a little bit ahead of the U.S. in this, right? Where do we start after this whole decade of where you really focus ultimately to get your sovereignty back, to get control of your country back? You fought the Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, David Cameron. And this is my point. It's not about political party. It's about a mindset of the established order. You fought. You won in June of 16, but they weren't prepared to pat you on the head, toss you the keys. On January 31st, it's supposed to happen. Tell us, and we haven't had a chance on the show because we've been so involved in the details of the impeachment. The reason we're doing these two shows is to set the conceptual framework for why there is an impeachment, why Donald Trump is being impeached. This is the established order fighting back with the raw viciousness that they have to fight back with. How did it happen in the UK that you had what I call the second referendum? You won a stunning victory, more than anybody ever projected. And now, where does that lead us to the 31st of January?
It's a really important episode yesterday because it's so easy to get trapped in this Ukrainian names and, you know, this billion went here and that million went there and this company did that. But you got to take a step back and realize why we're here in the first instance. The established order, the elites, they were not ready for this pushback. They thought they had it locked up from a very long time, and there are plenty of examples by which to prove this. They thought this on both sides of the Atlantic, that Britain would forever remain a part of the European Union, maybe even become further entrenched and even a lesser partner with less of a say in the Franco-German Union as the military union started to come together. And then in the United States as well, they thought that by 2020, you remember Soros and the Yale conference in the early 2000s, they put this whole plan together about reforming the US Constitution by 2020. That was the name of the conference. They thought that this was all going in a certain direction. They did not expect a populist revolt and said, actually, you know what, guys? We aren't really benefiting off this. You know, the established order as you like it, as you've seen it, might be good for your pocket, might be good for Hunter Biden's pocket, but it ain't good for the ordinary person out there. And that's why we are where we are right now.
You're saying Hunter Biden, you pick him up, not to pick on him, but say he's emblematic of crony capitalism, the aristocracy that really has been recreated, this between the City of London, Wall Street, the corporatist, and the permanent political class. Hunter Biden's what you end up with.
Yeah, and while the United Kingdom might be slightly ahead, a couple of months really nowadays, ahead on the push for the sovereignty elements of this, we're actually very far behind on the cultural wars. We don't have as great a civics education as you guys do in the United States. We don't have as much Christianity in public life as you guys have. So Britain in this new year is actually in for a little bit of a rude awakening when people out there recognize that actually leaving the European Union is the first step to getting your country back. It is not the be-all and end-all. The sunlit uplands are not right in front of us now.
Nigel tried still on the horizon. Nigel's Brexit party, which teed up, and his compromise actually led to this overwhelming parliamentary majority you have. He's the unsung hero in this. But he did say, what I heard him electorally, this is a year. This is really to do this is going to take a year. What do you mean that it's the beginning? And I keep telling people, don't think one election is going to toss you the keys. You just had a second referendum. What does that mean that this is just the beginning in Brexit, not the end?
Undoing decades of managed decline will take decades at a very minimum. Earlier in the calendar, or rather late in 2019, you had Boris Johnson, the new prime minister, going on vacation. But what did he do to go on vacation? He took a British Airways economy class seat to go on vacation and paid it out of his own pocket. For me, that isn't a world leader saying Britain is going to be booming and roaring again. This is kind of a whimperous way.
Is that faux populism?
Of course it's faux populism. It's pandering. It's trying to show to people, hey, we might still be spending $100 billion on foreign aid, but don't worry, I'm saving you £90,000 on the cost of an RAF flight when I go on vacation. It's silliness, right? And that's why I've never believed in Boris as the be-all and end-all of populist figures like a President Trump might be. He is in and of himself not this big change figure. He is simply a conduit which people are content with at the moment if he removes us from the European Union. But as soon as that's done, Britain's going to start looking at other things that I know a lot of people in the United States are looking at the moment, which is family policy, which is the cultural Marxism that's creeping in everywhere, which is trade
populism,
policy.
Populism, nationalism, traditionalism.
And it's trade policy like you raise, right? Britons don't want Singapore on the Thames. They're not interested in this neoliberalism on speed. That's not why they voted to leave the European Union. So I think that this coming year, Boris Johnson will make a number of these neoliberal steps while trying to do this fake populism, and he'll get blown out by the electorate as a result.
We're going to talk about Peter Navarro's economic forecast for yesterday and kind of the convergent factors of Trump's economic policies are coming. But I want to go back to the election because, as I said at the time, Brexit and 2016 are inextricably linked. And you remember, you were running Breitbart at the time. We broadcast live from over there. We were all over the Brexit thing because we knew that if that happened, and when it happened, that's when we said, hey, Trump's going to win this. This is now a real revolt in the West. Talk to us about the shocking elements of, and it wasn't just about Corbyn's personality, the shocking elements that came together that gave this 80-seat majority to Boris Johnson.
Yeah, and that's the thing. A lot of people.
And what is it forecast for the United States?
A lot of people want to believe that it was just Corbyn himself that was unpopular, and of course Corbyn himself was unpopular. He's a very unlikable human being and a very unlikable politician. But at the crux of what Corbynism represented was this: we're not going to take a position on Brexit. We're actually going to go and renegotiate, and then campaign against our own renegotiation. And it really came across as quite immature to the voting public, who have followed this in granular detail now since the 2015 debate started happening about the 2016 referendum. So you had Boris Johnson coming along, and he ran on something very, very simple: get Brexit done. Not what type of Brexit, not how we're going to do it, just let's get it done. Because there was tiredness, there was exhaustion with this whole thing. They had turned, and I remember you and I, Steve, were in Texas when I said this. I said they've turned Brexit from a rebellion, a phrase of active rebellion, into a process argument, and people were just tired of it, sick of it, and get Brexit done therefore became a very powerful mantra. Now, in the last couple of weeks since Boris Johnson's been re-elected, you've had him talking about amnesty for illegal immigrants, you've had him taking this economy flights, pandering, populism, you know, nonsense stuff.
Let me go back to and talk about the tee-up for the 16 election. We've got a couple of minutes, we're going to go to commercial break here in a second, but Dominic Cummings had some focus groups of lifetime Labor Party members, talking to them about economic policy, etc., behind the glass wall. He gave them, I think it was a TV4, I saw him, I think it was Birmingham and Manchester. And these people, none of them like Corbyn, but the simple reason they weren't going to vote for it, they go, where is he going to pay? Where's the money going to come from he's going to pay for these policies? It, to me, reflects what is going on in the Democratic Party is when Elizabeth Warren gives the details of her Medicare for all of a sudden the air starts coming out of the balloon. My point, working class people want granularity. Working class people want details. They don't want to be spun anymore. They've been sold and spun enough. Those people came and voted for Boris Johnson because they were tired of being spun. In the 30 seconds we got left, what say you?
Why do you think Elizabeth Warren is now struggling so much to keep her campaign? She doesn't have the excitement on my base. She can't get the money. going. There aren't these like loads and loads of small donors flocking to a campaign to fund this thing. And it's because there is a lack of belief there. It shows that there are only policies against populism that is creating an economy, not just a stock market, an economy which is working for ordinary people. She's in opposition to that. And the Democrats are lining up in opposition to that right now. It's the same thing that happened to Jeremy Corbyn. I think the Democrats are going to be blown out in 2020.
There's our first, in the Roaring Twenties, our first show of the decade. How do people get more information on the War Room?
Warroom.org is your one-stop shop for everything related to impeachment, and that includes all of this, the campaigns, the economics, the trade policies, everything at warroom.org.
We return with the Roaring Twenties in a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room, impeachment. On the John Fredericks Radio Network.
It is Wednesday, the 1st of January, in a new decade, 2020. We're at the War Room on Capitol Hill, just yards from where a few weeks ago President Trump either did or did not get impeached. We still haven't quite figured that out. Episode 95, the War Room impeachment. We're here every day, 7 days a week, even on New Year's Day, until the day after the exoneration of Donald J. Trump and the acquittal of Donald J. Trump by the United States Senate. John Fredericks Radio Network, Salem Broadcasting, America's Voice, and of course, Newsmax TV. Raheem Kassam, we saw the essentially the impeachment of a little bit of Nigel Farage. He ended up odd man out in the United Kingdom. Why has the established order fought so hard? Why are they, you just predicted a big win for Trump, but why did they feel that they had to go to the step of actually with this Ukraine? And you were in the Ukraine in 13. You saw the beginning of this sideshow to a sideshow, driven by Brussels, right? Driven by the geniuses of the Franco-German project. Why did they have to end up, why was their solution to stop Trump impeachment?
Well, it comes back to a question you asked on yesterday's show. And this is, where was the intellectual pushback against populism? What were the elites going to do to convince people that actually they should continue with these transatlantic or trans-Pacific trade partnerships and all these things that we're seeing, jobs sucked away, stagnant wage growth, all of this? There was no intellectual pushback. So what they're doing now is they're taking the argument outside of the intellectual framework. They're taking it to things that they think people don't understand. And if people don't understand them, then they'll be more likely to trust what the CNNs are saying about this. And one thing I think that it's fair that a lot of people don't understand is Ukraine. Is what happens in Ukraine? Where is Ukraine? What has it got to do with us? What has it got to do with the EU? What has it got to do with Russia? And what does it have to do with President Trump? What does it have to do with Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, all of this stuff? And as long as, remember, it's this mantra, this mentality, you don't need to read the papers. We'll read the papers for you. We'll read the documents out for you. And that's what they're trying to do on this Ukraine issue. When you put people up on stage, constitutional lawyers, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Fiona Hill, all these guys, the mantra is very much the same as it has been. We know better than you.
We're your betters.
We're trained to do this. We got this. Don't worry. But instead of operating within the intellectual framework that they're now coming to grips with the people understanding, they're trying to take it out of the established intellectual framework. This isn't about Christianity. It's not about your family. It's not about your job. It's not about wages. It's not about your community. This is about foreign policy. And the policy, what do they call it? The policy network or the policy community,
right, in Washington? The Washington Consensus.
But what does that mean? What is a policy community?
The interagency consensus.
But what is a policy community? If you think about it, policy is set by the people that are elected to set it. But they're now claiming that there is a separate policy community that is better than all of those people, the elected people the electors.
People do not pick up, and I noticed this when Theresa May and the team came over here in the first weeks of the Trump administration. The what's called the deep state, but I say is the anonymous, you know, coup leader or senior, you know, representative calls it the steady state. Mm. It was very much the British civil service that defeated Brexit originally, right? They determined it was not proper. They determined they were against it. They are a moral equivalent of Fiona Hill and Ambassador Taylor, are they not?
Yeah, and also saying, remember, if you want to go down to granularity, also saying, you know, the Queen has no right to prorogue Parliament, and we're going to get the British Supreme Court to weigh in on that. Queen absolutely has the right constitutionally to do that. And it's just another one of these little bits of offense that they still have left. Because guess what? Again, our side, we didn't have within our framework the ability to go to constitutional lawyers and say, hold on a minute, that is actually something we can do. And they're relying on the same thing happening here. They're relying on this show not existing, quite frankly. They're relying on people like Peter Navarro not speaking up. They're relying on Matt Gaetz to not storm the skiff. They're relying on our institutional knowledge to be low and us to be beaten back by the tens of thousands of operatives in the city, which there are. Tens of thousands in the foreign policy community, and for us to go, you know, this is overwhelming. We can't possibly do this. We can't possibly take these guys on.
What does this mean for the decade ahead? What does this mean for the Roaring Twenties? We've had Peter Navarro walking through a very optimistic, or you know, the sunlit uplands on the economic side. How do you think this breaks through, and how do you think it breaks through throughout Europe? Because what you and Farage were able to ignite, what Trump was able to ignite here, and now it's on a global scale. In Europe, you've seen it. Has it? Is populism and economic nationalism on the rise, or did that peak in May of 2019 in the European parliamentary elections?
I think of it a little bit like a wildfire, you know, and the wildfire can be beaten back a little bit, but you can't really stop a crazed wildfire like this. And here's the thing. They might be putting out little parts of it here and there. They might have stomped on the gilets jaunes in France a little bit by creating a vacuum of news coverage around them. They might have got Salvini out of office for the time being by making it impossible for him to govern the way he wanted to govern. They may have delayed Brexit, but actually new fires, bigger fires are popping up. When Britain leaves the European Union, for instance, a big fire is going to pop up within the EU institutions. How are we going to plug this budget hole? How are we going to plug this leadership hole? How are we going to deal with the military capabilities that we used to rely on Britain for? Remember, a lot of these European countries, they can't put a single battalion on the field. They just are unable to
do that. You're saying, although it stays in NATO, as far as the European Union, Macron's European Union army concept, that gets imploded.
It might exist, but I mean it'll be a handful of Danish soldiers that you're threatening to put on the front lines with Russia instead of British soldiers, which are a completely different thing.
Let me go to a lot of things that are pointed to you, and particularly to you and to Nigel and to obviously Trump and myself and others, is that this is all nativist, this is all xenophobic, this is all racist. Immigration as the particularly in Europe. Talk about the European situation on immigration. Where does it stand today? How's it played into the second referendum? Because it was very big in the first referendum, the second referendum of the election. Where do you see it going from here as something right now that's just below simmer?
Well, it brings me to somewhere where I really wanted to be, which is Germany. There's another fire popping up in Germany right now. It's linked to what I think is going to be a technical recession for Germany in early 2020. And it's linked to the 2015 Merkel, come one, come all, we can handle everything. The Germans are now finding out, the Swedes are now finding out, all across Europe you're finding out not only could the institutions not deal with this mass migrant wave, but you're also getting cultural degradation as a result. You're getting a rise in anti-Semitism because of the importation of...
rise in Semitism was because of right-wing, and guys like you stirring it up.
Well, that's what de Blasio would have you believe, but actually look at what's going on in New York City. These aren't right-wing guys that are going into Jewish households and into synagogue stabbing people. This is the inextricable, and it's something that is ineffable, really, about multiculturalism, that when you say to these people, we are not going to take you to task over these intolerant ideas that you're trying to import into our countries, or these intolerant ideas that you have perhaps harbored within your communities for so long, then this stuff starts happening, and it's happening all over Europe.
This is the Roaring Twenties. It's the first show of the decade on War Room Impeachment, 1 January 2020. Raheem Ghassan. Raheem, how can people get 24/7 in this new decade information about what we're doing?
Well, we're really going to be ramping things up at warroom.org in 2020, so make sure you check out www.warroom.org. Make sure you're subscribed. There's a free newsletter, so you're alerted to every show and every breaking development that takes place here and on the impeachment saga. And also make sure you're signed up and subscribed on Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, Google Play, etc., etc.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back on War Room Impeachment. The Roaring Twenties, Raheem Ghassan, Stephen K. Bannon, will return after a short commercial break.
Bannon, Miller, Ghassan. War Room, Impeachment.
On the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Welcome back to Capitol Hill. It's 1 January in the year of our Lord 2020. Yeah, we are, 20 years into this now? Or 19, depending on how you count it. The beginning of the Roaring 20s, a decade like no other, is before you. And it's going to start off with a bang. We got a massive election in Taiwan about the freedom of the Taiwanese people and a standing up to the Chinese Communist Party, the great existential threat to the United States of America. And then, of course, the trial of Donald J. Trump, the impeachment trial in the United States Senate, only the third time it's happened in the history of this republic in our, 240-plus years of existence. Worm Impeachment's a show that's on every day of the week, 7 days a week, from 9 a.m. to 10 East Coast time, until the day after he's exonerated. On the John Frederick Salem, America's Voice, Newsmax TV, Raheem Kassam, the personalities that have come up in this entire process. Let's talk about Tucker Carlson has been one that's done that journey. You've known Tucker for a long time. He's done that journey from a standard stock, a conventional Republican to a fire-breathing populist.
Yeah, what I call the bow tie brigade is the establishment Republicans, and now into the very much on a has been on a journey, and you can see it. You can see it from if you've followed his writing, and if you followed the podcast that he's on, the MSNBC to today to the show in the evenings.
The journey of the Daily Caller.
The caller, the very very much. Not concerned, Tucker, with the day-to-day minutia of politics. And I don't think he'll mind me saying that. You know, he doesn't really care. And he's right not to care.
They don't really cover the impeachment.
They don't really, on Tucker's show.
Only some basic stuff.
Yeah.
Just enough, because he doesn't think, in his mindset, he's told me, he doesn't think it's transitory. He's looking for bigger, deeper things.
Yeah, he's looking at the foundations of American civil society. And I think it's so great what he covers every day, because he's pulling stuff out and he's freaking the left out on an almost daily basis. The heads at Media Matters and Mediaite and CNN and Washington Post, they spin daily. They can't believe the things he says on there. They can't believe that he used to talk about, you know, drag queen story time hour in these libraries. And now, of course, that is a major concern for people out there, and they're seeing it permeating throughout their communities. Tucker has been one of these, I think, culturally transformative figures over the last couple of years. He's made people sit up and take notice of not just what's going on politically, not just what you can call your congressman or senator about, but what you can do in your own families, your own households at a very local level. There's been a good, I think much better than anywhere else that I know in the Western world, a good thing about homeschooling in the United States and making sure your children have those values.
You've brought up a point that, and this is for the American audience, although our audience is global here, the cultural issues, and particularly the cultural issues related to populism, economic nationalism, and I say the third leg of the stool, traditionalism, you believe they're going to come at the forefront now in the United Kingdom and even in Europe. You see Marielle Le Pen, she's a leader. You're considered one of the leaders. Are these issues that Tucker Carlson's talking about that are not economic, that are not driven by the populist economics, are they now going to start to explode in Europe?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. You're seeing them exploding in Europe now. Marion Maréchal has this university out in Lyon as well that covers a lot of this stuff. You're seeing it take root in Germany. You're seeing people talking about this massively in the United Kingdom.
Beatrice Storch is one of the leaders in the AFD is all over this. The Le Pens are starting to get all over this. Salvini is huge in this.
Yeah, and because here's the thing. People are seeing, they're hearing from their children when they're coming home from school, and they're looking at their homework, and they're looking at what kind of curriculums they're being set in schools, and what they're not allowed to say anymore, and questions they're not allowed to ask. And it's very interesting from a Generation Z perspective, and this is really Generation Z's decade that we're on the at the beginning, the first day of today, is you're seeing them rejecting this quite naturally in a much larger way than millennials rejected the cultural Marxist stuff. And so you've got teachers, and I see it every day, you know, on my Facebook page, I get people direct messaging me things that are being taught to their kids at schools and screen grabs of the homework and things like that. And you're seeing a younger generation saying, hold on a minute. I understand that we're supposed to have like tolerance towards each other. I don't understand that we're not allowed to ask questions. I don't understand that we're not allowed to have opinions about this stuff. And so I think you're going to see the rise. 2020 is going to be a cultural war decade.
You think it's a cultural war decade and a lot of this could be led by Europe. That you think that a lot of these social conservatives or traditionalists have kind of been undercover that could be at the vanguard of this revolt in Europe.
I think they thought, the establishment thought, that they had eradicated Christianity and Christian values from the continent. They certainly thought that about the United Kingdom. Actually, it's
this is where the Judeo-Christian cultural aspects reasserts itself.
And actually, it's just been more dormant than it has been eradicated. People still think of themselves.
So
as
the Media Christians. Matters guys are going to say this is the Christian Taliban. This is the throwback to the worst part of the Inquisition, everything like that. What say you in 30 seconds?
I don't need 30 seconds. I say I can't wait. I mean, this is going to be a real throwdown. This is, you know, the forces of good and evil are going to collide in a big way, and we're going to be there at the forefront of it. And we get to see it, and we get to fight that battle.
Don't say I'm the most apocalyptic. I got Raheem Ghassan. Okay, take a short commercial break. It's the Roaring Twenties, 1 January 2020 here in War and Peace. Stephen K. Bannon, Raheem Ghassan. Be back in a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room, Impeachment.
On the John Fredericks Radio Network.
It's 1 January in the year of our Lord, 2020. We start a decade, ended a decade last night at midnight. Historic in its disruption, historic how the tectonic plate shift in global politics and global economics started by a massive financial crisis that we still haven't gotten over. Today shows the Roaring Twenties. It's episode 95 of War Room Impeachment. We're on every day until the day after the acquittal slash exoneration slash vindication of Donald J. Trump. These two specials will talk about the decade behind us, what caused this populist revolt, and the look ahead. Raheem, I want to talk about news cycles and compression of news and how people, you know, handle this. In this first quarter of this year, just a couple of things. We're going to start with a incredibly important election in Taiwan that really kicks off the year about the standing up to the Chinese Communist Party, about the freedom of the Taiwanese people. We've got an election now in March in Israel, the third election they will have in a year. We've got the Democratic on February 3rd, the Democratic primaries start at the caucus in Iowa, followed by New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, and then Super Tuesday. We have the trial of Donald J. Trump that is going to start sometime around mid-January, I think. It just seems like for the average person, is there something about the technologies has done this? Is just the content? Is because people like Trump and these large personalities are now on the world stage, and we're just in that type of, you know, fourth turning environment that drives this type of thing?
Yeah, I think it comes back to what you've always said about the fourth turning. This is, again, I'm going to
do you believe
this.
In that? Because I think this is the OK boomer in what's happening in Hong Kong, what's happening in Beirut, what's happening in Tehran, what's happening in Chile, what's happening. You see the difference in generations, right? It is a little bit generational warfare. This is the OK boomer that you guys so love to heckle people on. Do you believe in the construct of a fourth turning?
Yeah, I do. I don't think it's anything particularly new. I think it's just been forgotten. You know, you can go back to the Thomas Cole paintings and look at the rise and falls of empires, and this is something that we have to return to knowing. I want to come back to this. This is going to be a decade of good versus evil, and you can tell by the way it's being set up. Like you say, look, just think about it a little bit. Taiwan is not this far-flung province that we think of as unrelated to anything to do with here. This is about the evil that is being confronted all over the world, that is the Communist Party in China, right? You're seeing the same thing in Israel. You're seeing the evil that is Iran. This has direct implications
for
that.
The CCP's partner. Of the naval exercises that are taking place.
The partnerships. And so you're seeing this. I think, you know, we had a lot of this take place in the turn of the century about the war on terror, right? But actually, it hadn't really fully formulated yet. The sides hadn't really truly been picked. Now the sides are very clear. There's only a few players who I think are still on the fence. Turkey, maybe, although they kind of decided where they really want to be, but they're still in NATO at the same time. So, you know, there's still something.
Yeah, I don't think the resurgence of what's going to be the Ottoman Empire is on the fence. I think he's made his choice. It's just Turkish middle class made their choice.
That's the point. Have the Turkish people decided that they're going to follow this guy?
The provinces have the Istanbul. The cosmopolitan Istanbul definitely have not.
And then again, you can bring it back to the United States. You've got a trial of a president, of a directly elected president, taking place, and a trial that really seems to hinge on Bupkis. It seems to hinge on a foreign policy dispute, which, by the way, there are a quadrillion of every day here in
Washington,
D.C.
This is the point I want to get to. In the scale of things that are happening, and now that it's really getting to people that a decade ended, and as we try to give the perspective that, hey, there were these underlying forces that drove this. Trump just didn't pop out of The Apprentice out of nowhere. These are these deep underlying that he galvanized and represented and manifested and took forward. And that's why this decade is so important. One of the problems that Democrats are going to have is the smallness of all this as it proceeds through the trial. And then in hindsight, when people look for retribution or really for his vindication of the polls, is it going to be the smallness of what they impeached him on?
I think when you fail to teach basic comprehension, comprehension is what allows people to go and predict and project forward. You have to understand the background, you have to understand history, and you have to understand the current environment. The media classes, alongside the Democrats, they don't have basic comprehension skills. They can't really piece together what's going on around there, and that's why they think Trump came out of nowhere. They think Farage came out of nowhere. They think Salvini came out of nowhere. They think Marine Le Pen came out of nowhere. They think that most of Israel hates Benjamin Netanyahu and that this is going to be a blowout. And, you know, this is the third election. And despite all of the things they keep throwing at him, he keeps coming and maybe not winning them outright, but he keeps coming back. He keeps, you know, he's like one of those punch bags who just knock you straight back in the face. And I think they're going to fail to acknowledge that this time. And the Democrats are going to fail to acknowledge that in 2020 as well. The basic underpinning of the economy right now and the things that are impacting everyday people's lives, the things they're seeing in their communities, in their schools, in their town centers, in their libraries, their roads, the small little details, they don't comprehend how this fits into their worldviews.
And talking about comprehension, you were very early on. We've been on this project since 2013. You were one of the first people to point out to me the importance of someone like Viktor Orban. Mm. Why is it that the established order and their media propaganda department, whether it's Modi, whether it's Abe, whether it's El-Sisi, whether it's Bolsonaro, whether it's Salvini, Le Pen, Trump, Farage, but they have a particular thing that Viktor Orban, for some reason, even how everybody else triggers him with the same type of thing, Orban, for some reason, triggers him, I think, given the relative size, it's a 10 million, you know, it's a North Carolina, essentially. Yeah. Why does he punch above his class in the triggering of the mainstream media?
You know, I think Orban triggers them not just because he's a God-fearing man, but also because why black conservatives trigger them, right? Orban was supposed to be their guy.
Because he was a part of the system. He was a communist and a part of the system.
And Orban went to, he had a Soros-funded education. He was inside all the thing. And he realized from the inside out, hey, wait a minute. Not just me, not just my friends, not just my family, not just my people, my entire country, Hungary, a very proud country that has had a very, very gritty and grueling past. My country is being taken to the cleaners as a result of this whole machine that is the European Union and the Soros Foundations, the Open Society Foundations and all of this stuff. And so Orban especially triggers it. And Orban, I predicted maybe 5-6 years ago, would be one of the single most important European leaders on the world stage. And people laughed at me.
I know,
they
I remember
absolutely
that.
Laughed at me. Hungary, the Prime Minister of Hungary, you don't know what you're talking about. And the same reason I was in Ukraine, by the way. I said this is a major flashpoint. People rolled their eyes. They said, Ukraine? What does Ukraine have to do with anything? It has to do with everything right
everything.
Now.
Everything. And it's leading to the impeachment of the president. At least that's the excuse. Okay, War Room impeachment. Take a short commercial break. The Roaring 20s. Raheem Kassan, Stephen K. Bannon. Go to warroom.org. Get all your latest updates. We're going to return with a summary of the Warring 20s in just a moment.
Bannon, Miller, Kassam. War Room impeachment
on the John Fredericks Radio Network.
Episode 95. On the first day of a new decade, it's the Roaring 20s. We're trying to set the contextual framework for the upcoming trial of the century, which will be the trial of the 45th President of the United States and his impeachment. Okay, Raheem Kassam, my wingman and the wingman of Nigel Farage, you've had a pretty good role the last decade of talking about where things were going. You were in the Ukraine 7 years ago, knew that was important. Orban, Brexit, everything like that.
Just think about how many other people can say that, by the way, from at least the policy community in Washington, D.C. They all claim they're experts on it. None of them were there. None of them saw what was taking place.
No, it's not. It's one. You. That's where you're working here.
That's the only reason.
I've got a pretty good, and you're cheap.
Now that's true.
You're not expensive, no. I've always had a pretty good eye for horse flesh. This decade, let's tee it up. We're going to start, you know, starting tomorrow, we're going to get back down into the nitty-gritty of this trial of the century. It's coming upon us. It's historic for this republic, but it's set within a bigger contextual framework. As you see it now, looking over the other side of the hill, what do the Roaring Twenties, what should people be looking for? How is it going to start? Is it going to be, you know, muzzle velocity coming out in the next month or two that leads us into something?
I think starting in Britain, we leave the European Union on January 31st. We're fully out by the end of the year. And that means it could be WTO terms of trade, or the European Union could get their act together and do a trade deal with Britain. It won't be a comfortable 18 months to 2 years after that. There will be some hardship as we try and figure out what our role in the world is. In the United States, you will see the acquittal of President Trump. You will see a big victory for President Trump,
exoneration, acquittal, and it will be a non-conditional acquittal.
And there will be something with the Senate, the Republicans in the Senate, I believe. He will have to compromise in some way. But what's also standing out to me right now is the back chatter about what a second Trump term looks like. What staffing in particular looks like. They're talking about his family leaving.
What's his family talking about that? But yep. You're assuming that there's going to be a second Trump term. What leads you to that belief?
No. I'm 100% metaphysical certitude about it. Right now, if the elections had today, I'm Michael Moore on this.
I should trademark that phrase.
You should. If the elections had today, he would win, and I don't believe any fundamentals will change. Economic fundamentals will change. If they do change, they're only going to change for the better. Any economic fundamentals, they don't look like they're going to change before
in
the election.
In a mobilization election where they mobilized, you know, beat us by 9 million in 18, you don't see their mobilization being able to work under any circumstances.
I don't think they have the candidate who, they've got better data and they can mobilize more. They don't have the candidate that gets those people out.
Okay, to kick off the Roaring Twenties, how do people get updated every second of every day on information?
www.warroom.org, at warroom2020 on Twitter, and of course, subscribe. Everything is on all the platforms, podcasts, YouTube, Facebook, all over the place. You're not going to want to miss it. It's a massive, massive deal. The impeachment coming down the line and the election.
The only thing I can tell you is that it is going to be more intense every day.
That means whatever, 3 shows a day.
whatever the forecast is, we'll see you tomorrow live back War Room Impeachment 2020.